Remix has nothing to do with synthesis.
Exactly.
As such.
So, yeah.
I wrote to both and said to them, look, you cannot have the Remix site being a friend to Moog.
Yeah.
I said the whole point of Remix being devised the way it was totally, should we say, as a total put down of Moog, because Moog, the first Moogs, they were nothing more than Clee-Kit oscillators and such like. There was no artistry, there was no musical synthesis in it. They were just sound generators, which you control with a few pots. Mm. And Daphne's concept, right from the start, was she said, "I want to be able to compose my electronic music as a musician." The electronics has got to be a means to an end, not an end in its own right. She was quite adamant about this. Mm. But again, when things go on the internet, they're there forever, aren't they? People say Daphne designed the Remix machine. She never did. Mm. She never even designed the mechanical part of it.
No, yeah.
It was her brother, John. And when John called me several times when I met him, he used to go absolutely spare about this. He said, when Daphne approached me about this machine, I said, well, what do you want to do? She said, well, I don't know. He said, well, you want me to build it? She said, well, yes. She said, but I don't really know what I want, but it's got to be able to do this, that and the other. He said, well, how many tracks do you want? She said, well, I don't really know. He said, everything I asked her about it, I don't really know. So he said, well, on the table.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
We'll come back. We'll pause.
Yeah, we can pause there.
So we'll start properly then. So it's the 28th of November 2012. I'm here with Graham Wrench and James Bully. I'd just like to start by saying, Graham, if anything we ask you, or if you're not comfortable talking about anything, just feel free to say I'd rather not, or whatever.
That's accepted.
But you seem pretty candid, so I'm not too worried.
Whoops.
No, it's good. It's great. And yeah, if you feel that we're kind of missing the point or asking you the wrong thing, feel free to flag that up as well. Just yeah. So just to start off, could you tell us a very brief synopsis of kind of where and when you were born, and a brief overview of your career as it stands and your interests? Just a very sort of.
That's going to take the rest of this recording space.
Very briefly.
Yeah. I was born in 1937 in South London, and for some reason always had a technical interest, very practical, hands-on type of youngster. My greatest regret was having passed my 11 plus and been diverted to a grammar school where no one understood my ideas of hands-on and technology, except the physics master and the music master. But the music master was particularly interested in me because my father was very much involved in the London musical scene with the London Symphony and the Philharmonia orchestras and the various musicians and artists involved there. I was drawn in an uncanny way towards the idea of electrons. And I almost empathised with an electron. So electronic circuits to me were, well, I'd read them instead of a novel at bedtime. So I started to build little sound amplifiers because sound was obviously very much part of our family's background. And having built an amplifier, I then obviously wanted to put noises through it. So started understanding microphones and gramophones. And it became a situation that at the end of the war, and when I was getting a teenager, my father suggested that it would be a nice idea if we could record audition pieces for returning musicians. So could we have a studio at home? Which is how I got to actually build our first home recording sound studio and made a disc cutting device. Thus, lots of individual musicians would come home, we'd make the recordings, and I got involved not only with the technology of sound, but also the artistry of instruments. Just a little sideline as to how my brain started to work. My father was a bass player, and one of the basses, which had a lovely sound, except for one string, which tended to wow and woof a bit. And talking to me about it one evening, we decided to set up an oscilloscope, which I had built, and a microphone, and he would start to play individual notes, and we'd watch the responses on the oscilloscope, and we'd say, ah, that's where the trouble's beginning to occur. Let's alter the bridge, let's alter the soundpost. And so we started to actually, if you like, tune the instrument. And having done it on his instrument, it became recognised with the professional studios that here was a lovely sounding instrument. Why can't the others sound like it? So I started to study individual instruments in this way. My own career then, I obviously didn't like my academic studies at the grammar school, and I came of the age where I had to do call up for national service, and I decided that I was not going to go into the cookhouse or go on guard duties and things like that. I wanted something much more well-defined, so I opted for radar with the RAF. I was told that I couldn't do that because I hadn't got my academic qualifications, certainly for short-term duration. So I said, well, look, what's the minimum requirement for me to get in? And they said, well, if you've got the knowledge, we could take you on a four-year engagement, but you need to sit the entrance exam first to see if you qualify. I sat it there and then, declining 6 months learning period. Apparently I passed because I was taken straight in on the RAF radar fitters course. I then, having been demobbed, went into a sound recording studio in London, actually almost opposite Broadcasting House in London. And it was there that I started to make use of my contacts in the musical world via my father, and doing classical recording sessions, learned sort of the fine balancing acts between technology and artistry. During this time, I had met Daphne Oram, both when she was recording, or rather broadcasting concerts from the Albert Hall, and also when she was setting up the Radiophonic Workshop. And she introduced me to people like Desmond Briscoe and some of her other colleagues. So I knew what she was about and what some of her ambitions were. And then we lost contact with each other. From the recording studio, I then went into medical electronics and developed quite a number of electronic devices for use in operating theatres. Until one day I got a phone call which said, Graham, I've got a problem. I wonder if you might be able to help me. Who's this talking? Oh, sorry, I'm Daphne. So Daphne invited me down to her new studio in Fair Seat in Kent, near Rootham. And she introduced me to her idea of graphical sound. She was wanting to design a piece of equipment whereby she could compose electronic music, but as an artistic musician, not as a technician. The only thing she said to me at the time, she said, I've spoken to a large number of my contacts, both through the BBC and elsewhere in the world of sound and sound recording. They've all said, yes, Daphne, I think your idea is possible, but God knows how. She said, and that's as far as I've got. So
there's actually some good material in the archive of that correspondence, which I could show you some of at some time.
I'd love to see it, because
there's letters from her to people within the BBC and the physics department of Chelsea Polytechnic and different stuff. So
somewhere, some on the continent as well, I believe.
I haven't come across so much, but I think there is some correspondence. Yeah, she certainly went to see kind of the RTF studio and things, I think, didn't she? So.
Yeah, there are definitely a couple of letters. There are a couple of letters that are over to Europe to two universities that I've seen. Yeah. I think even someone in New Zealand that she corresponded with quite a lot. Okay. There are a few letters there as well.
Yeah, because Tristram Carey was one that she originally contacted, I think, as well at that time. But I can only surmise what Daphne's motives were, but she never actually expressed in any sort of detail to me the contents of any correspondence and the feedback and such like. So I was starting literally absolutely cold. So at this initial meeting with Daphne at her studio, she showed me a kind of Dexian framework of a piece of mechanical equipment which had some strips of film on it, which she said her brother had designed for her. And when I asked what the various film strips were intended, what information they were intended to convey, she said, well, we don't really know, but we think we will need them. I sort of gulped and said, yes. There was a big drum which was going to carry various forms of magnetic tape, which whatever these films might produce could be recorded before being transferred to her beloved Brenel machines in her main studio. So I then asked her, I said, well, what about sort of the initial electronic components which are going to be behind all this equipment? She said, well, we don't know what we want and what is needed. And I said, well, what do you mean by we? She said, oh, well, I have a young engineer who helps me out at the studio, named Fred. She said he makes all my leads up for me and such like, and finds what's gone wrong if things don't seem to work properly. She said, but he's a post office engineer, actually, and he works with relay circuitry, so he's not really that clued up on the electronics. She said, what we've done, she said, we put a couple of pieces of equipment together in my sort of games room. So I said, oh, well, you better show me, please. So she took me through to her games room, in which there was this lovely old billiard table covered with plywood and a couple of sheets. And on it was two Heathkit pieces of equipment. Heathkits were sort of commercial type domestic kits for electronic equipment. One was an oscilloscope and one was an oscillator. So I'm afraid I was rather rude and outspoken. And I said, well, you can throw that oscilloscope out. That'll be useless because it's so non-linear and so much distortion in it. We won't know what we're looking at. I said, anyway, what's the oscillator doing there? She said, well, what do you mean? I said, well, you said you wanted graphic sound, not electronic sound. Oh, well, won't you need an oscillator to check your circuits or anything if you take the job on? I said, well, I certainly wouldn't use that oscillator because, again, it's so full of distortion, it's untrue. I said, no, get rid of those. I'll start from scratch. She said, well, she said, are you saying you'll take the job on? I said, yeah, I can fix it. Somehow in the back of my mind, I knew what was required. I again, hadn't got a clue how I'd go about it, but thought, well, if Daphne takes me on, we can talk this through and gradually we'll get some specification which we can build on.
And can I just ask, was that after she'd got the grant from the Gulbenkian
Foundation? Yes, she had already received the grant.
What year are we talking when you first met?
This would be, what, 64, 65, somewhere in that order.
Right, okay.
Yes, if I sat down carefully and worked out my timeline of where I left various employments, I'd get it absolutely right, but it's in the archives, I'm sure. Anyway, I said to Daphne, well, yes, I'm quite happy I'll resign from the medical research business and I'll see if I can build you an aeromics machine. And that is how we left our first meeting.
Was she referring to it as the aeromics machine at that point? Did she have a name for it?
Yes, it was going to be the aeromics machine. Now, there's a lot of confusion, I think, certainly on the internet, about what is recorded on the aeromics machine. There's aeromic recordings and such like. Daphne's had a basic holding company, which was the Electronic Music Supply Company. I was employed basically by that company, and she had my visiting card made out in that name. Aeromics was the name of her studio within that company. So Aeromics existed from the word go, as far as Daphne was concerned. Sounds from the Aeromics machine, which are often attributed to it, couldn't possibly have been from the Aeromics machine, because that machine didn't make any noises at all until, what, 67?
I think it's 66.
Christmas of 66.
She wrote to the Gulbenkian Foundation in 66 saying that the prototype was working, and that was towards the end of the second grant.
And that's when I first met Carolyn, as she was then known as Wendy, a little teenager with her brother. They came down one Christmas to visit Daphne at her home, and Daphne demonstrated to them the first tune we ever wrote on the machine, which was The Holly and the Ivy.
I haven't come across the tape of that yet, but
I hope you don't.
We have found some quite early aeromics. I mean, I'm trying to be very thorough about differentiating the aeromic studio from the output of the aeromics machine.
I
know there's some confusion.
Good.
With the Science Museum
totally
exhibition
wrong.
And generally the releases, and we're trying to be quite thorough and tie up those loose ends, and there's various pieces. Actually, I probably should have brought some, but I've got a couple with me that perhaps I could play you later and you could comment on. But
well, bear in mind, of course, that I'm not privy to any of the real output of the machine, because I left Daphne long before it went into any sound production mode. But certainly talking about the mixture, the Science Museum issued some sound from the archives for a competition, didn't they?
That's right, for a remix competition.
Yes, and a lot of the sounds there certainly did not come from the aeromics machine, and quite a few of them actually are just basic tapes, actually played backwards.
Oh, really? They didn't.
They hadn't even realised that some of the tapes they were playing were back to front.
Right.
And I actually talked to my friend Katie English about this. And she said, I listened to that, Graham. She said, yeah. And I twigged it. She said, but why the Science Museum never did, it's beyond me. So we had a good laugh. But this is the idea of the total confusion that exists about this machine.
Well, hopefully we'll be trying to put the facts straight at some point.
Well, I can help you, but I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. It'll be very interesting to play you some of the things that I think are from the machine. I've got other questions about that a little bit later on. So we've answered my first four questions. Of your own accord here. So, well, perhaps you could just going back quickly. Could you just tell us briefly what you got up to after the aeromics episode, and then we'll come back to that.
Personally?
Yeah, in your career and personally.
Oh, right. Well, what I've never really mentioned to anybody is how deeply upsetting the departure from Daphne and the Ceramics Machine was. And it was probably the trigger that some years later led me to have a couple of very bad nervous breakdowns, which obviously have preyed on my life in the intervening years. But immediately after leaving Daphne, I was completely shattered. I did a bit of freelance photographic work, having always been very interested in photography and running my own darkrooms. I then actually applied for a job with a company you may have heard of, Pearl and Dean.
Oh, yeah.
I went into their audiovisual department as a development engineer, and I actually designed the first closed loop circuit television advertising medium, where we used a 16mm projector to project adverts in bingo halls of all things. So I went from the sublime to the ridiculous. But this was the first totally, if you like, fully automated cinema projector. Not quite sure what happened after Pearl and Dean. Oh, yes. Having designed several bits of audio equipment for them, I found myself getting more and more disillusioned with life in London, to the extent that one day, travelling home on the tube, I was running down the escalator, as one tends to catch the next tube home, and I suddenly stopped and I thought, you bloody idiot, what's all the rush? The trains are coming in once every 2 minutes. I usually stand at the back of the platform until the crush is over, so why am I running down the escalator? I'm just being a lemming, aren't I? Okay. I'm going to get out of London. And my wife and wife agreed, and we eventually found a little thatched and flint cottage in Norfolk, near Thetford, and we moved. I then took up an appointment with a company called Airwork Services Limited, and I did radar maintenance at a local radar station, until I got rather disillusioned with that in the civilian attitude to radar technology. And I applied and got a job with a local electronics production firm that was having, shall we say, a little trouble in their reject department for producing little amplifiers by a gentleman that I better be very careful what I say, Sir Clive Sinclair. They were his main subcontractors for producing some of his domestic equipment, and they were getting something like a 70% reduction, reject rate on production. So I went in there to do that fault finding, and after a lot of hassle, we got it up to decent levels, nothing more than about a 2% reduction of fallout. But after lots and lots of arguments with Mr. Sinclair himself and his engineers, who actually were brilliant, oh, my hat goes off to them for what they came up with. I then left that industrial section where I actually instigated a lot of the off the job training for the production staff, mainly women, and got qualified as an industrial training executive with a government certificate, as it was at that time. But anyway, I left that particular employment, and I took a job as a packer for an organ company, out of work, and you had to go to, as is happening even these days, you have to go to these facilitating back-to-work projects run by the government, which were absolutely diabolical, abysmal, demeaning, you name it. It doesn't really give you self-confidence. And it was only because I said, look, forget all this. If you've got the cards of what jobs are available, let me look through them and I'll find something that looks interesting. Because they said to me, oh, with your qualifications, we haven't got any job suitable for you. So I saw this advertisement, packer required for an organ supply company. I went down for the interview and a chappy interviewing me said, oh, with your experience, we couldn't possibly have you as a packer. Let me talk to the directors. I think we might have room for you somewhere else. And I went in as a technical development engineer with designing or testing and production of some of the more modern approaches to controlling church and concert organ, pipe organs, with electronic control systems. Unfortunately, my health was deteriorating and I had to give up. Depression and anxiety got the better of me, so I became unemployed again. At this stage, I decided that with the mental state I was in, there was no good my trying to even think about really my photography and my interest in electronics and such like. Because if I tried to do something and I failed, I would have just proved to myself that I was beyond hope. So I looked for something that I'd never done before in my life. And that actually happened to be wood turning. I was useless at woodwork. I couldn't put a nail in and knock two ends together to put a shelf up. But somehow I'd got hold of a wood lathe, and having put some wood on the lathe, I realised I was producing some very artistic pieces of work, to the extent that over a few years I became recognised as a master wood turner for restoration wood turning, for antique furniture and unique designs and such like. So for many years I was able to bring up my young family purely on the proceeds of my woodcraft. Now what happened after that? Better have a pause there while I have a think.
Wants to race to the end too fast, yeah. I think.
If you look at the circuitry, even within the Oramix machine, you will see that the layout of the components is more artistic than technically necessary.
Right.
You will find that the colour coding on the resistors follows patterns that aren't required technically.
I'll be coming across all of that very soon when the machine comes off display and I get to poke it and prod it a bit. I'm hoping they'll let me loose with a multimeter, but I don't know if they will.
I'm surprised that they are.
There is very little in that machine that actually couldn't be functional now.
No, I'm sure. Electronically. Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Are you going to be allowed to try and...
I don't know yet. I've got to make an application to a conservator and then it's...
That conservator doesn't know what he's talking about either.
I think he's left the guy that stabilised the machine.
Yeah. He was asked what sounds it would have made and he came up with nonsense.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a podcast, I think he said he didn't really know.
But the one I heard, he said, with my background or my knowledge of physics, I think the sounds would have been somewhat so-and-so.
Right, right.
You don't know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in a way, it was designed to be able to make most sounds, wasn't it? Almost.
You
could have any combination of
sounds. We're
coming
to that.
So let's. Yeah,
okay, you want
to
pick it up?
So the next question I have is kind of, can you tell me in your own words about the development of the Oramix machine? I think you've kind of covered that. Is there anything more you want to go into? Or did you want to carry on with after the wood turning?
No, we'll just carry on from the wood turning because it brings a bit of closure. The wood turning was obviously taking place during bouts of depression. being out of work and having to submit accounts to Department of Works and Pensions and all the rest all the time. And they said I should be getting gainful employment and so on and so forth. I went for more job interviews and I got transferred into taking a job as a training officer with the local district council, where I was employed as an instructor for teenagers who had been dismissed school and with learning difficulties and such like, which wasn't good for someone in with a depressive capacity and suffering from anxiety nervosa. But, you know, we got on well and I made some good friends with the youngsters to the extent that they would always acknowledge me if they saw me walking downtown. So we developed some rapport. I then got talked into having to take other various menial tasks, shall we say, just to get my benefits. But my health was deteriorating quite a lot, and in the end it was regarded that I was long-term medically unfit for employment. So that is basically where I started to have my last 10 years of employable age, if you like, as mentally unfit, let's face the facts. And I went into retirement where I had my own photographic darkroom, where I did some freelance work for friends and contacts. Again, I would do all the jobs which other people couldn't quite fathom the mysteries to. So never made much money out of it, but kept body and soul together. And hence I've ended up into retirement until contacted over the Oramics machine in the last couple of years. So that's my life history.
Fascinating. Thank you, Graham. Yeah, I think it is very valuable when to know who's talking.
If things go wrong, you know, I'm not deliberately trying to mislead you. It's just that I have a mixed-up mind and I have to admit it. So
I don't think anyone sort of knows all the perfect sort of factual aspect of their life, though. I misremember huge amounts of things that have happened to me, especially talking to my parents. My mum has a very clear mind, but I talk to her about my childhood and it's almost like I've just made most of it up. Like,
yes.
There's memories that are in completely the wrong places, things that happen that are in the wrong country, and just like...
Well, so she tells you.
Yeah. No, thank you for that.
Exactly.
You asked me about sort of the early development of Oramics.
Yeah, so if you could, it's very much of interest. Yeah, if you could tell us a few of the kind of
how
you settled on the parameters and the trials and tribulations and.
Well, the first few weeks of sort of being fully engaged with Daphne, it was spent in discussion, nattering, argument, bickering. She was obviously a very strong-minded person, but then, in my own way, so am I. So we made a good sparring pair, really. And I did get some support from her brother in the fact that he would say, she's got brilliant ideas, but she hasn't got a clue how to put them into practice, and she never will have. She needs people like you and I to keep her feet on the ground. So Daphne and I would then say, well, all right, you've got these film tracks and you want to produce film, you want to produce sound graphically. Do you really mean you want to draw sound? She said, well, yes. She said, you've got the soundtrack on cinema film. She said, you've got all those waveforms on it. She said, they're really only sort of similar to the sound patterns that you see on an oscilloscope. She said, so that's graphical sound. Why can't I draw things like that? So I then said to her, yes, but the amount of information that is recorded on those soundtracks on the film is far more than you'll ever be able to draw freehand. Every nuance, every harmonic, you're going to take weeks and weeks and weeks just to produce a couple of notes. I said, I don't think that's probably what you have in mind. She said, well, maybe not. She said, what other ideas have you got? I said, well, you don't want to produce the sounds from an electronic generator because that is going to be rigid and inflexible. No matter how many you put together and no matter how many you blend, if you have that number to make a musical sound, you're going to spend all your time trying to blend these blasted things rather than creating a sound. I said, I think probably the way we should go about this is that we are going to create our sound really from a basic unit, a single cycle of sound, a single cycle of the frequency. The shape of that cycle will have some bearing on the timbre. You will then be able, if we string those together, one after the other, so you get a continuous note, as, say, being played by a wind instrument, you can then modify that graphically by being able to draw the volume control. The volume control will then become your dynamic parameter, because you can bring the volume up fast as the attack of the note, or you can bring it up slowly, to fade it in. You can then, having reached your particular operating volume, you can then sustain it, which is another important part of the note, and you can do the decay. Now, whereas a normal decay is a negative exponential, we can actually decay it with a positive exponential, if we like. That is under your graphic control. Ooh, she said, that sounds interesting. So, okay, we've got that. Let's have another track, perhaps for adding a little bit of vibrato. Yes, can we do that? I said, yes, we can change the rate at which our note is being scanned, frequency-wise. Same as we can do a little bit of amplitude modulation as well, if we like, just by putting another control onto our volume track. We can run those in. Our biggest problem is going to be pitch. We better decide what sort of frequency range you want this machine to cover. So we decided, well, obviously it's got to be within a sensible audible range, but we've got a snag. If we're scanning individual, and this is when I first used the word, I think, scan individual cycles of a note, we want to change the frequency. If we look at the frequency scale, we're talking in sort of decimal points of a cycle, certainly in the bass frequencies. We can jump to sort of full digital one cycle per second increases for things above sort of 1 to 2,000 cycles. And I use the word cycles because I don't like having to use the word hertz. To me, cycles is a graphic information about a repetitive ongoing sequence. Hertz is like it's like volts and amps, isn't it? It just doesn't give me a graphical image. So we decided that we would work on a basis of one cycle per second increments throughout the audible range. And Daphne looked at me with absolute horror on her face. I can't put that many dots on my films. I said, well, there's no need to. We can digitise this. We can use a binary code. And if we have four pieces of film which cover the various decades from Unity up to the thousands, and we can actually combine, if you like, 0 to 9 steps with just four dots by using a weighted binary. Having seen Daphne's eyes glaze over, it was then a matter of introducing her to a little bit of binary theory and such like, and then explain that all she had to do is to put a little dot on a piece of film that could be read by a bit of electronic circuits and say that is one cycle per second. One cycle per second of what? And this is where Orramics becomes quite fascinating. We have a scanning oscilloscope, basically a spot on a cathode ray tube that scans from one side of the tube to the other. in a very, very time linear fashion. Having got to the end of the scan, it's got to get back to the beginning again, and this is where most oscilloscopes would let you down, because they will take time to get back to the beginning. So this scanning machine is designed so that the time it takes to get back to the beginning again is at least 10 times faster than the highest frequency we want to hear. So that sets sort of basically the 100,000 to 1 mega cycle flyback timing set, which I've talked about previously. So this again is a little bit of circuitry ingenuity to force the flyback rather than let it take its own time and re-trigger. This should mean, if I'd got my ideas right, that if we were to draw a pure sine wave and scan that at any particular frequency, it should sound like a pure flute sound. If there is a slight discontinuity at the flyback from the end of the cycle to the beginning of the cycle, you will hear a buzz. And that is a no-no. That means I haven't done my job properly. The other parameter was that you would need to set the start and finish datum line of the cycle very accurately on the scanning waveform as you see it on the oscilloscope. I've seen in recent years people just saying, oh, well, this waveform was scanned by the Oramics machine. And I look at it and I think, but there's no start and finish. It would have just been a noise with a buzz in it. Most of those sounds would have been very, very similar, no matter what you drew, because the buzz...
The zero crossing has to be...
Has to be zero.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So you have to start and finish exactly horizontal relation to each
That's
other.
That's right. Yeah. And it's not as difficult to do as it might seem, because you could just tweak the waveform until it's start and finished on time-based line, and then you could just... the amplitude of the scanning wavelength to fit between the start and the finish. So those controls were actually built into the machine that if you didn't get your initial sound graph absolutely right, you could tweak your... Gee, Trevor, yeah?
That would be amazing. Yeah. Thank you.
You would then get that right. The thing is that in any one particular cycle that you draw, you're not going to get a particular... wide range of timbre from it, are you? You can draw a single cycle.
Anything will sound boring if you just hear one thing repeated.
Yeah, but then you've got your other parameters on the film strips, which are going to give you your dynamics and such like. You can draw second and third harmonic distortions in, and they will give you more of your woodwind or trombone or string sounds. The interesting thing happens if you draw more than one cycle on a film, and you're scanning perhaps three or four cycles, you can actually draw a little more timbre into it. But now add 3, 4, 5, 6 scanning systems in, maybe operating at different frequencies, maybe operating at the same frequency. You're now building up a complex waveform, which is within the scanning system. It has nothing to do with the composing machine or the programmer, as people have now named it. So that no matter how complex your waveform, your actual composition is just as simple. So that now you've got a machine where you can compose any sound you like. It's up to your imagination and your understanding of the physics of waveforms. You can choose virtually any frequency. I notice that now on the machine as it stands in the exhibition, that the frequency generator has been adjusted to play an even, equal-tempered scale.
Yeah, as I understand it, there's notes in her logs that where she tunes it differently. I think she must have got frustrated with digital binary, just as an extra abstraction in the process of getting from thought to composition.
It goes back on what you wanted to do, which is to do something outside the normal experience of music.
Yeah.
Now, I don't think that would have been Daphne's predilection to do that. Yeah. I think she was pressured to do that from outside sources. I've got my own inner feelings, if you like, as to where some of this pressure might have come from. But that certainly would have been restricting Ornamics as a development machine, but certainly would have facilitated it as a commercial machine.
Yeah.
So she's got those contradictions within her life to balance out.
Was she... all of the kind of things going on in Germany at that time, in Cologne, the Schoenberg's work and the more kind of atonal stuff, what was her feeling towards...
I have no idea.
Because I just wondered, because it sounds like there was the potential here for an incredible sort of... It's not even microtonal, it's smaller intervals.
Well, you could make any interval you wanted. At all, yes.
But the potential, composition-wise, as a composing machine, to just completely be free... from tonality in a way that I'm trying to think of anyone else doing anything at that time where they had that much freedom, but I don't think they really
no one had that freedom.
Yeah. There's a tape actually in the archive, something she's just recorded off the radio, I believe, about different scale systems, and I think there's several that were kind of put forward, aren't there, but I think this is the 32 note octave.
Might be the Harry Parch. Maybe the Harry Parch stuff.
It was some Dutch guys, so not Harry Parch, but I know he was...
You see, I'll have to come clean on this. I'm not a musician. I'm apart from what I like to hear in terms of music, I'm not... Yeah, come in and join us, will you?
Well, Alan's here for a minute. So
all right.
Yeah. All right there.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Yeah, you're still recording anyway, are you? I've never got involved in the sort of the theory of harmony and scales and such like. And I think Daphne was somewhat protective of me, that I was developing this machine, not just for her, I was just developing the machine, and she didn't want my mind to be influenced by any other external sources. Anything that machine was my creation on her behalf.
Yeah.
And I'm being a little bit presumptuous on this, perhaps, but the actual operation of the Ornamics machine is my concept. The concept of graphical sound is Daphne's concept. So I think, you know, we have those two very different situations. And when I left, remember, my initial design was such that it was all modular. And I stressed right at the beginning I would build it this way so that it would be expandable ad infinitum, because this would have built up the complexity and the versatility of the machine. So after I left, Daphne was desperate to get, because I only did a single track version, basically, a single scanner. Daphne needed this to be expanded. Her friend, Fred, who looked after her studio, came back onto the scene, and he admitted that he couldn't match building all that stuff that I'd done. So they then got quotes to have it built outside, and they realised what a frightening expense it was to have some of these circuits just remodeled, even just copied. So eventually I think she got a couple of other willing, handy technical types to come in, and they expanded. And as far as I can tell from the pictures I've seen, they are absolute clones of what I originally built, which I'm quite, shall we say, satisfied over, because that was the intention of building it that way. The other thing which I always like to stress with the Ornamics machine, I don't know whether you two have picked it up, but one of the most, I suppose, profound developments of that machine was the volume control. To my knowledge, no one had previously engineered a completely non-mechanical volume control. All previous ones, whether that was the light volume control that BBC developed, or there was another system that required a servo mechanism, which was developed in Holland, they all required some sort of a mechanical input somewhere along the line. The Oramix machine has a totally new, totally electronic volume control, which went from silence to maximum dynamic output. Automatic volume controls obviously were known about because they appeared in the automatic volume gain controls within radio sets and things like this. But they were usually only over a dynamic range of about 10 dBs. I was covering at least 60 dBs with a single stroke of a paintbrush on a 1-inch width of film. I believe that was quite something.
Yeah, that is remarkable. Yeah.
Now, when you think about it, the zero had to be stable. And since it's a graphic device, which is being read by photocells, you've got an illumination source. Now, we didn't have LEDs, we just had little torch bulbs. And as we all know, the light sources begin to diminish over time as the tungsten evaporates and masks the inside of the globe. So this would give you a zero shift all the time. So within the volume control was also a light balancing control, which meant there was a constant light source being fed to the photocell. So there were, if you like, envelopes within envelopes within that, just to get that dynamic range. And the fact that it worked, I felt quite chuffed over. So that Oramix machine had a number of quite definite firsts, didn't it?
Yeah. So can I just delve into a bit of detail there? I don't know how much you can remember, but in terms, obviously, the digital control had, you said, four sensors per strip of film, so making a four-bit number in each one. So with the volume control on there, and I think there was sort of also timbre mix controls.
Yeah, they were purely analog.
Yeah, and they were purely analog. So did they just have one sensor each?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So you had to. So clear film was
zero.
Clear film was zero, and then the more black you had, the louder it got.
Yeah. Well, you see, there was a mixture of controls. The volume control was a miniaturized version of the scanning system, in that it was a miniature CRT, I think, I can't remember exactly whether it was a 1-inch or 1.25-inch diameter cathode ray tube.
The volume controllers?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
So that you had a single spot of light from the CRT, which would be lifted backwards and forwards across the diameter of the tube according to how far up the line was painted on the film. And the output from that CRT then became the voltage that was being fed to the
So it was a mini version of the scanner.
But it wasn't scanning.
Right, okay.
It was a stationary spot.
Mm.
Right? So that gave, and any of the films that had a wave shape to them would have had this CRT light source. The frequency control was individual photocells that read each of the four tracks on individual films, and then they were weighted as zero or one, zero or two, zero or four, or zero or two. So if you add those up, you get 0 to 9, don't you? And then you go on to the next track for the next decade. And those just to sort of harmonize you in terms of the machine, those are those lovely little colorful circuits with the red coils of wire on them and the reed switches.
Yeah, I gathered that. I understand more about the pitch control than the other controls, to be honest, at this stage.
Yeah,
so that was a digitally controlled resistor capacitor network you would change capacitors for decades and resistors for fine time constant. Yeah, that's as I understood it.
And the reed switches were used because they were, at that time, the only mechanical switch which had a fast operating time, better than 1 millisecond.
Mm. Okay.
Whereas if you used ordinary relays, a relay make and break would be timed in sort of 8, 10, 12, 15 milliseconds.
Right, right.
Which was a bit too sluggish.
Okay.
Plus it took a lot more power, didn't it?
Yeah, I think, well, I'll delve maybe briefly into mini-ceramics after this, but there's finding, because that's what she went in and was trying to perhaps develop as a more, you know, deployable commercial kind of something that could be used in schools or studios, and something that could be mass produced more easily. And already I'm finding a lot of the concepts electronically are flawed. So, because as we've discussed, her understanding of electronics was
minimal,
pretty minimal. Yeah.
Yeah. An individual note of sound music and electronics.
Yeah. I believe. Yeah.
I read that and it made my hair curl. You know. There is so much there, putting forward that I know and I understand all this, and yet when she explains how a transistor works or a time constant, she has just picked that out of my notes that I wrote to explain to her. I'll have one, please. With all due respect to her, you know, why should she be expected to understand electronics on top of everything else? You know, that wasn't her forte. The fact that she could twist, the fact that she could twist sort of knobs on oscillators and switch tape recorders on and off, you know, it doesn't make you an electronics engineer any more than just plugging up systems does it? You see?
We had
lots of trouble over all this.
Something that really fascinates me about the Aramics machine.
Or
Daphne in general, I think, is whether or not she perceived the Aramics machine as an instrument, as a piece of technology, or as basically a kind of composition in itself. And I know that seems like quite... They're three quite important...
Yeah. Can you expand on how you mean as a composition in itself,
so,
machine?
So she would compose, and in that perhaps the idea in her head would be that it would act almost like an orchestra, where she was inputting a score to it, and it would be a playback device, almost like she wanted it to be an instrument.
Yes, at which she would compose her music. In other words, she would perform. The idea, it was a performance machine. For the composer, not for a public performance.
Mm.
She would perform on the Aramics machine the same way that a musician would perform on any other instrument.
But purely studio. Because there's an interesting... is it Yehudi Menuhin at the time? I in fact think she might have this same quote in the archive, but I sort of slightly adhere to it in that for new music there has to be new instruments to some extent.
Mm.
I slightly sort of agree with that, but I mean there are problems with it. But one of the other really interesting things at that time is obviously you have someone like Peter Zinoviev taking a partitura for an unattended computer out into the Queen Elizabeth Hall and turning it into what I would imagine is a very studio-based thing, into a performance and trying to integrate it within the kind of... the system of how music was working at that time, as far as public performance, and I wondered if that was ever something that she
no
intended,
not to my knowledge. Say she was a very private person. Our discussion, we covered certain personal issues certainly, and our individual philosophies to some extent came into a lot of our arguments and debates. But primarily, the Aramics machine was the holy grail of a teenage fantasy of being able to draw sound. As you know, she was inspired by Bacon's "We Have Sound Houses," and that captured her young teenage imagination. She was already into sort of music and studio techniques and such like in her mind, and that just blew it, literally. And I think it nagged and niggled in the back of her mind all the time that there had to be something which nobody else had done, conceived of, or could perhaps even copy, if you like. She obviously was well versed in, if you like, classical music concepts. Otherwise, she wouldn't have been such a brilliant balancer as she was. She was almost, I would say, up to the equivalent of the German Toymasters. She obviously had a sonic imagination which enabled her to do her tape manipulations. And they were because they afforded her the means to producing a sound complex which she couldn't get out of conventional instruments. It was just natural for her to abuse, I won't say distort the sound, because that is the wrong concept in my mind, but to abuse the sound by playing it backwards and to adjust the playback speeds and dynamic. The other thing in passing, do note that the Aramix machine was one of the first machines, probably the first machine, that enabled you to do time stretching and compression without altering pitch. Now, that had never been conceived before, and even Daphne hadn't realised that the machine as I designed it would do that until I demonstrated it, which was, of course, an absolute godsend commercially. If you had 10.5 seconds for a commercial and you'd written a piece which was 11.25, just put it on the Aramix machine, if you composed on a Aramix machine, and you could adjust it to 1/10 of a second with no problem whatsoever without altering pitch. So that was an eye-opener. Couple that to taking that output, putting it into her basic studio and letting her do her tape manipulations, you know, the world was her oyster.
Just going technically back in again to what you and Daphne achieved in the with the Aramix machine and so on. I've read all of her kind of proposals, and I think for the grants and so on, and I think a lot of those and also her updates to the Gulbenkian Foundation and so on, and in that she describes a machine which would have feed off and take up spools for the film control tracks, that, and also then a multi-track recorder to enable to layer up composition, so because it's essentially monophonic, even if you can make very rich timbres, it's playing one line of music. Absolutely. And then so she, in the proposal and in her concept of this, as far as it's written down, as far as she's you would be able to construct a long piece of music with the film spooling off and being taken up, and then put that to tape, go back to the beginning, put down another track on top. As you understand it, did that, because listening to the material, listening to the tapes, it doesn't seem that likely to me that that actually was ever fully, I'm not sure.
Nope.
You mentioned the big drum of the
which was to run the 1-inch strip magnetic
synchronous tape. Yeah.
I never got as far as being involved in that. My attitude at the time was I got enough on my plate to get the basic Aramix machine running. As far as the recording on the tape is concerned, that is basic audio hardware, which we can buy in off the shelf anyway. We had a good relationship with Daphne and Brennels, and they would have supplied her the tape heads and any other mechanical resources for sound recording that she required. So I didn't feel under any obligation to even consider it in my mind.
You certainly didn't see it operational in that?
None of that was in operation at my demise.
Okay. Um, So when you did your initial experiments, when it first, the prototype first kind of made...
Started to make noises.
Yeah, did you say it was Silent Night or these sorts of, in your first early...
Well, yeah, that was Daphne. Yeah. Daphne chose, yeah. What was it, the Holly and the Ivy?
Oh, the Holly and the Ivy, yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Would that have been running spool to spool or on a loop?
No, spool to spool.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. The machine as devised, I talk about the machine and the electronics. Mm. The machine as devised by her brother was originally spool to spool anyway. Mm-hmm. So that was part of the basic concept.
Yeah, I realise it's part of the concept. I just wondered if it had got stalled and never gone.
No, no, it got built as a spool to spool.
Yeah, because as it's on display in the Science Museum, there aren't really any. I'm still fairly unclear as how the spool where the film came from and went to, but
right. No, there were supply and take up spools.
Yeah, so are they on display?
I've no idea. I haven't really looked at that closely.
Right.
No.
Okay. What kind of a size were they? Kind of like 6-inch, 8-inch, 10-inch?
Just approximately.
I would certainly say less than 10-inch.
Yeah.
I think you're nearer right on sort of 4 to 6 inches.
Yeah, I had a feeling that it might be quite small.
You guys should have a Skype conversation when you have access.
Yeah, well, certainly I'm going to take photographs and try and make schematics, and then hopefully Graham will be willing to comment.
See, it's very difficult because I think it must be difficult for outsiders to understand that I left the project just as it was coming to life. So I never really got to develop a second scanner, and I don't know how people have blended that in and mixed that in, whether they were using independent time bases. The time base I built would have been capable of driving at least 4 or 5 other scanners directly in synchronicity.
But not at different pitches.
No,
on the one pitch.
No,
yeah.
But if you built separate time bases, then obviously they would have all been
independent. Yeah, so you could have made chords.
Could have made chords and... This is where I say it was so flexible. It's absolutely mind-blowing and fascinating what it could have been. I think one of the first interviews I did about this, my parting... Oh, it was when Steve Marshall came and did the article interview. My parting shot to him said, but it was a wonderful research tool.
Yeah.
Apart from anything else.
Yeah. Well, I think, I mean, certainly from what I've read, what she wrote about it, even before it was built, she certainly looked at it in that way. She certainly wanted it to be used not only for music but for sound research, you know, as a tool of physics as well as music.
And that's more or less how I approached it anyway.
Yeah, it sounds, I mean, very much the kind of that ultimate flexibility and the modularness and the 1 hertz steps on the time base. I mean, on the time base of the scan of the pitch. Yeah.
That was just, if you like, an easy introduction to frequency control of the sounds. Analog would have been a no-no on that.
You'd have no precision, really. It would just always drift.
Well, yes, we could have stabilised it to a large extent. But
your positioning of the dots on the track and everything would be...
Yeah, you could be within error on those. Yeah. As long as they covered the photo cell, you got the pitch. But yes, that probably is the biggest stumbling block to being a compositional machine. But I'd likened it, you know, when you're learning an instrument, the fiddle, the position of the fingers, they alter every position you go up the fret, don't they? You've just got to learn automatically. And after you've been at that machine for an hour or two, you know the pattern of dots that gives the particular pitch you want.
Yeah.
You're not calculating the pitches all the time, but it's just that we're so used to sort of, if you like, certainly from the keyboard, a fixed position for a fixed pitch. You're not thinking of patterns. It's position, isn't it? Mm. Position, position. Whereas here, it's not position, it's pattern. Mm.
Yeah, it's much more like software than hardware in that respect, isn't it? It's,
But the whole driving thing that we came back to and we talked about it over and over and over again was I am not just a composer, I am the performer.
Yeah.
Mm.
And I want to feel that dynamic.
Mm.
I want to feel that note. So it was to try and get that relationship between the emotional person, the artist, and the technical person. And that, of course, is why I complained right at the beginning when the museum set up. I said, you cannot have the Allramix machine and we like Moog. Mm. Because Moog is the antithesis of Allramix. And you cannot have Allramix and synthesizers. And that's where synthesized electronic music has no relationship to the Allramix. That Allramix is actually a thorn in the exhibition, really. Mm. it's the other way around. They're using Allramix as a stepping stone to electronic music and synthesizers and all the rest of it.
But it's much closer to a sequencer than a synthesizer, really. Mm. Much closer to that.
Yes.
I find that, like...
And it's almost it's a sampler, isn't it, as well?
Yeah, it's
sampling itself.
Yeah.
You see, it's a self-sampler.
And a scoring tool, but before that sort of... I mean, I suppose Cardew was around that time, but, like, before graphic scores really became a thing, it's also as having a visual aspect.
I think graphic scores have been around a while, but having them directly read by a machine is the leap
more
there.
Isn't
it?
Yes, a lot of graphic scores were actually a code to an end, weren't they?
Mm.
Mm.
Whereas the only code in Allramix is the frequency control,
and the rest of it's direct.
Everything else is direct. Analog to sound.
Mm. That's more what I mean by graphic score. So the sort of improvisatory graphic score, the notion that, like, that object sounds like whatever you choose to make it sound like, not a translation of. But it's,
And
it's
of course,
very interesting that notion.
And there was a development which I had in mind for Allramix, if you like, Allramix Mark 4 or 5, which was a colour scanner.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow, yeah.
You see? Which is translating colour hues into sound. So if you could get an output which was variant on the colour and the density and the hue, and you put that in as the controlling element as the waveform for the scanner, replace the scanner by that information, now you've got a colour reader, orchestral or musical interpreter.
Those wonderful colour organs.
Do you know the work of F.C. Judd, Fred Judd?
Yes.
Yeah, because I don't know how relevant you'd find it, but he had sort of working the other way from sound to pattern and image and colour to a certain extent. But I think Oram was associated with him through sort of amateur tape recording clubs. And
I believe so, because he was very much a writer for the general public on such like. A lot of it was technically sound, a lot of it was really just reproducing what was known in terms of particularly electronic organs of the time, of which you had the two types, didn't you? You had the Comptons, which were harmonic analyzers or combiners. You had the draw stops, which just gave you different intensities of the different harmonic contents of a particular waveform. Or you had the other one, which was the tone wheels, either magnetic or the optical tone wheel, which again, you see, was really the circular interpretation of the film track on a film, wasn't it? The score on the film track.
I know when Daphne Oram was, she talked about it in some of her lectures, the telharmonium, which was the very early kind of Hammond kind of an idea, but done in an unbelievably
That is a ludicrous thing.
It's pretty crazy. But still, it was, you know.
Well, of course, the theremin is certainly under the, was it his granddaughter now, who's the exponent on the theremin. She gets some fascinating results out of it. Really, quite artistically and musically.
Yeah.
If only that could be turned or linked in to an Oramix type sound source, so you get entirely different timbres.
I think, am I right in saying the theremin's a beat frequency oscillator? So it's two ultrasonic frequencies interfering, and that's the interference that you hear. So that would inherently make it quite rich sounding compared to a normal oscillator, as it
were. Yes.
Yeah.
As radio builders of the day, heterodyning.
Yeah, that's right.
Takes me back to super hets and TRF radios.
Yeah, they used to be the really high, top notch ones, didn't they?
Oh, yeah, super hets, yes. Mm. Yeah, communications receivers.
Mm. Right, let's get back on the schedule here. Is there anything, I'm just thinking, is there anything else more technical about the Oramix machine? But I think I will wait until...
Till you've started to pull it to bits
exactly,
a bit more.
Exactly, yeah, and whether they'll let me pull it to bits, I'll keep you posted. But
Well, they must...
Yeah, so, do you know, museum attitudes sometimes are a bit, shall we say, dog in the manger, aren't they? I can understand them wanting to archive something super special, but if you can take something to bits and put it back the way it was, then why shouldn't you look inside it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if you get a load of junk into a museum and we reassemble it, like Trevor's done with this little shunting engine...
Yeah, it's so much more valuable now.
It is so much more valuable in the end. And the fact that we can give footplate rides, we can demonstrate, we can give lectures on it, it is a much greater asset to the museum than it was as a pile of junk, which, you know, we weren't allowed to touch.
Yeah, well, it's also with the... I recently was given the example of... I've forgotten the name of it, but the first computer that was built in Manchester, the first digital computer...
It's
in a museum, but they've rebuilt it and it's operational. But it's just in a glass case, not being operational. So it's kind
is
of
that in the Turin exhibition.
I'm not sure.
Because the first commercial one was Leo, wasn't it, with Lion's Corner House? Mm. That was the big first commercial. Mm. I remember seeing that going into operation. But
It is problematic for them though, because they have big catch-all policies that
apply
to. It's like I borrowed in an exhibition recently of some of Hugh Davis's work, because he founded the Goldsmiths Electronic Music Studios, and there'd never been an exhibition of his stuff, but I managed to catch that archive just before it got accessioned into the British Library. So it was held in the British Library, but it hadn't been catalogued, which meant I went in and met the head of Rare Books and Manuscripts, and he just gave me a bag of stuff, and I just walked out, and that was that. Whereas in this situation, that could just never happen at the Science Museum. Anything that goes in there is accessioned on the way in. They don't hold collections, so it's kind of like...
I can blow hot and cold over the Science Museum, you see, because as a child, I would visit the Science Museum at least twice a month. Again, it linked with the Albert Hall because that's next door.
Mm.
So if I went up of a Saturday afternoon, I'd spend Saturday afternoon in the Science Museum, and then I'd go to the Albert Hall and meet my father for a concert or something in the evening. So in that way, I got known by some of the curators at the Science Museum. And when I arrived, they'd usually look out for me. Oh, young Graham, we've got something you might be interested in. Here, come and have a look at this. And I'd go into the back cupboards, you see.
Yeah.
And they'd let me have a look at things, and they'd try and explain things. So they really whetted my appetite and kept me fascinated by what was going on. And I look at the Science Museum now, and it is so cold and distant, and whatever it is interactive, it's interactive remotely. Mm. And it's sophisticated because it's been designed by an artist or a creator or a PR guru. It's losing the basics.
I think they're desperately trying to reintroduce it. I think they've kind of realised that, speaking from an archivist point of view or working in an archive, it's fascinating to me because it's like these journalists come in and they barely look at anything. Like, they'll look at a couple of documents, and mostly they'll just look through the photos and pull photos they want. And then they'll write all this copy that will be built out of other people's articles. And they'll have done, maybe they spent an hour in the archive, and they won't have looked in depth for anything. And the same goes for the Science Museum exhibition. No one came to the archive to do thorough research about any of it. And I sat there being like, I have all this knowledge, just ask. And they just didn't. No one said anything.
Well, so you know how I feel. So.
Yeah, I mean, for me it's less personal because obviously I believe that if Tom and I sort of work on the archive, I mean, we're coming from two different perspectives. Tom's looking at the Aramix machine very specifically and making mini Aramix potentially. And I'm looking at completing the archive and making sure the information is put out there to correct exactly this sort of thing. It's things like that, things like the birth of the Radiophonic Workshop, that horrific book by Desmond Briscoe that is just so factually inaccurate. But there are loads of things like her slightly more esoteric beliefs. People just completely ignore them, and it's that they're an intrinsic part of
her
why
makeup.
She's writing and what she's doing and her research. And then there's all like her incredible advertising work that everyone just ignores because, oh, well, it's advertising, it's not that important. And it's like, well, it is, because that's the vast bulk of the tape archive. And it's incredible work. Like,
and because she was, because of her esoteric background, she could be quite vulnerable in many areas, which is why her brother said to me, she needs people like himself and myself to keep her grounded.
Yeah.
Not just from a financial point of view, but, you know, what is practical and what is possible and what your aspirations are, and not go off into airy-fairy, rather nebulous situations which may or may not be.
Like a kind of harmony of the spheres thing.
Yes, to some extent. You know, I've got my own sort of quite weird philosophical approaches too, but I can also be a technician. Daphne found it difficult to separate some of the more esoteric influences in her life and her artistic musicianship. And one or two of her friends would play on one side rather than the other because it suited their ends rather than her ends. And I think, you know, this is where, unfortunately, she got led astray somewhat in latter years. And all the work on the BBC Micro, she should never have even started on that, because the BBC Micro, for what it offered, even in the master, it wasn't a patch on the parameter control that Aramix was.
I was going to say, in general, what... Well, first of all, something I wanted to ask earlier, did you have any contact with her post when you left after?
No, none whatsoever. She refused point blank to have any conversation, any communication with me whatsoever. Now then.
Do you want to go into that at all today? Or
no, but I'll just say, I'll say this, you might as well know. It was somewhere in the early 1990s. I phoned her up and I said to her, look, Daphne, we've been at loggerheads for so many years. I still don't know why I got thrown out in the way that I did. Are you prepared to talk about it? Because I'm prepared to apologise whatever I've done, and I don't know what I've done. I'll apologise. Her reaction was directly, put that in writing and I'll think about it. I said, no, I'm putting nothing in writing till we've talked, Daphne. And she put the phone down.
Incredibly stubborn person, I think.
Well,
like, I mean,
so am I.
Yeah. But it's, yeah.
Something, I will say, I have some inklings, but I don't know, so I won't say anything. But she was given some misinformation of a situation which I think was involved. this was passed on by, if I'm right, by a person who has very, very limited understanding of people. But she depended upon them to a large extent. She took them at their word and wouldn't even... When I arrived for work, she'd come back out of hospital. I'd been there over the weekend and got things ready for her for coming home. And then on the Monday morning, I turned up to carry on work with the Oramics. I was met by a row of six or seven people outside her front door. And someone came up to me and said, "You're not allowed in the building. If there's anything you want, I'll go and get it from the studio." And I had to there and then think, what is there of mine in there? Well, there's tools and there's books and there's diagrams. I just said, I want so and so and so and so. And I drove out. And that was the last contact I had. It was as cold and as cut and dried as that.
You didn't even see her that day?
Yeah, she was standing out the front, but shielded by her friends. Right. She didn't say anything. Yeah. And that is, she must have been severely hurt. So was I, but we could never communicate.
Was that after she was
in the hospital
with the carbon monoxide poisoning? Is that?
I don't know about the carbon monoxide poisoning.
I think that was later.
That was later, probably. Yeah.
I just wondered if she was ill at that point or something.
What was she in hospital for that time? Can you remember?
She was found by her caretaker. I don't know, she mentioned Mr. Harris in the archives. She had a small guardhouse, if you like, or bungalow. Mm-hmm. In the garden of the Oast House. And she let this rent-free to Mr. and Mrs. Harris, who then acted as her sort of, housekeeper and general handyman. I've forgotten where the train of thought was going on this now.
So what was she in hospital for?
Yeah. He found her one morning, slumped, unconscious in her studio. And
that was why she was then to ask about low frequency stuff in the machine.
Right.
That was what I was reading.
I'm just going to swing that up because I'd need to go to the loo before I answer this one. But just out of your technical interest.
Yeah.
Those valves.
Yeah.
You'll find those only on the power supply unit. So
when the amplifier.
The amplifier, yes. Those are the actual regulator neons that reference the output voltage. Because those are regulated and stabilised power supplies on there. 75 volts, very tightly controlled characteristics. Surprised I found a couple of those. Those you will find on the scanners.
Right.
Those are the high voltage smoothing capacitors for the extra high voltage for the tubes.
Okay.
I think I was running those at about 2,500 volts, but they would run down to about 1.5.
Somewhere you might be interested in this as well. Well, I should make a list, James, of the things I said I'd show you, Graham. But there's this amazing document that's called Instructions for Turning on the Oramics Machine.
Oh, I'd love to see that.
Yeah, I'll send you it. I think actually Meryl might have
together,
put it.
Yeah. Let's put together a kind
yeah,
of...
Yeah, we should put together a package. Yeah.
Yeah.
What was the thing I said earlier that I should show Graham?
I was quite amazed when I found my original test tape for the metallic exhibition, which you wanted to ask me about.
Do you think maybe we could
do that some other time?
Get a digital copy of that at some point.
I could try in doing that.
Yeah.
That will also have the that's not just the music, that will have the pulses on it too, for controlling the lighting system that was controlled with the...
Fascinating. So it's a two track, with one as a control track and one as audio.
Yes. Gosh, and didn't we have trouble over that exhibition too?
Yeah, I can imagine.
Have you read
when all of that sort of automation-y stuff was being invented, wasn't it? Well, yes. It wasn't very...
I don't know whether you've read somewhere my report of how I refused to allow the exhibition to go ahead with the amplifiers that they provided to begin with.
No, I've seen a spec that Daphne Oram wrote, it's like it's not in really tech speak at all. It's sort of like, make sure the speakers have big drivers or they will crack at the low frequencies and things like that.
Yeah. No, well, when we got there, the tape replay machine, loop machine, was atrocious. It wasn't designed by Mallard. You know, you thought Mallard House, they'd have used their own equipment, but they had a subcontractor in who built rubbish.
Right.
And I said, no, Daphne's not playing her music through that.
Yeah.
Go away and redesign it, and had to do that twice.
Wow. And you finally went ahead.
Oh, yeah.
James is very interested in that as being kind of one of the precursors of sound art as we know it. So, yeah, he wants to talk
and my original tape frequency setup tape, 7.5 inches per second, for setting up the bias and the frequency response. Yeah, I'm just intrigued to find
a few
bits and pieces left over.
I noticed something earlier that I recognise. The 2N3055s, you can still buy those.
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah.
I've used those on some. Yeah.
Yeah, good old power output transistors.
Yeah.
Yeah. But these.
Oh, yeah, extra high tension. Yeah, I've still got a bunch of those in my studio.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, said James, we'll probably try and do 20 more minutes or something. So, questions we've got left.
Well, you do yours.
Shall I read out briefly the questions?
Much more sort of urgent, more important. General sort of rambling interest questions.
Yeah.
But I may well email you a few.
Yes,
a few musings and thoughts.
Yes, I'm happy to muse. You know, nothing has to be absolutely black and white, does it?
Never is.
Okay, actually, there's masses of questions we've got left.
Okay, ask them some.
Let's go quickly.
Let's try and be...
Who would Daphne Oram have described as her musical peers, do you think, in 1960?
I have no idea.
Okay, that's fine, we'll skip over it.
Can I just very quickly... Did you ever see Tristram Carey?
Yes.
At the studio?
Yes. When Daphne was in her... We were talking about her hospital and her collapse, weren't we? She had invited him down to see the Oramics machine... She was in hospital. I stood in her stead. And he wrote a beautiful letter, which I think I passed to Steve Marshall, so you might want to contact whether he's seen it.
Seen that.
He wrote to Daphne in hospital saying how much he appreciated my intervention on his behalf. And obviously I lived Oramics. But yeah, and I've corresponded with him several times over the years. Mm. Because he moved, was it to Australia?
Yeah,
then? Yeah. I mean, he died a couple of years ago.
Yeah, not that long ago.
Yeah.
I went to meet with the British Library to try and secure his archive, and it is being sorted out in Australia.
Right.
Because I was, he had a huge tape collection of stuff that was going on around that time. He was very organised.
Yeah.
But then,
Getting back. Okay.
Shall we just finish off on
the hospital? That would actually, yeah.
She was found unconscious. You were asking about the low frequency effect. Mm. Initially, I wondered whether, because she would work so late into the night on her commercial work, whether she had left the Oramic switched on without using it, in which case it would have probably, I can't say for certain, but it would probably have set itself to a low frequency by default. Now, low frequencies have an effect on the organs of the body. Mm. I remember doing some demonstrations in a parallel with Chappie Briggs, audio fame. He used to demonstrate low frequency effects at an audience talking about high quality sound. I'm sorry if half of you feel you need to go to the toilets during my talk, he said, but please don't feel upset or ashamed. He said, I fully understand. And true to his word, half the audience would begin to filter out, go to the toilet and come back. And then after the interval, he'd say, I expect the rest of you are feeling quite pleased with yourselves. He said, but I can assure you the rest of you will want to go now during the second half. And at the end of it, he would then explain that the kidneys and the bladder were stimulated by certain low frequencies, and that there are two basic resonant frequencies to the human frame. And he said, during one half, I played one frequency, and during the other half, I played the other frequency. Right.
But do you think Daphne...
So I wondered whether Daphne had left this on.
Right. Do you think her playback equipment would have been...
On second thoughts, I'm not sure that it would have been good enough to have had this.
Sounding speakers...
Because those speakers are atrocious. They should never be in the Oramics exhibition, by the way.
Yeah.
They had nothing to do with Oramics.
Yeah.
So they were just her speakers?
They were just her studio speakers. Nothing to do with... Nothing audio... associated with that exhibition is to do with Oramics.
Yeah.
Because Oramics wasn't audio. So, you know, nail
that's
that one.
A really important distinction, isn't it? The idea that Oramics isn't audio. You
yes.
know?
Yeah.
It's good.
I'm glad you agree with that.
Yeah.
So,
well, it's
yes.
a good way of, like,
yes.
very concisely.
So, although I
the
voiced
problem.
The opinion and the concern, and afterwards I said, well, there would be some sort of switch off or safety device built into Oramics, because I never got round to doing it anyway. Mm. But no, in respect, I don't feel any qualms on that. I don't think that was the cause.
Mm. Well, she did later get carbon monoxide poisoning, so it may have been an earlier undiagnosed one. Or
yeah, but that yeah. seems
or it
that,
could be,
that
I was
seems
wondering
to be
about
from her quite antiquated cooking facilities.
Right.
Because
oh, yeah, no,
she went down, she certainly correct. Went downhill
yeah.
many years later after I left her.
Yeah, she
you know, from the '80s onwards.
Really
she
cook
went.
For herself. I think
yes.
she just ate an egg a day and
yeah.
did that for quite a few years. By the sounds of it.
So
oh, yeah.
Right,
just
I don't know her musical peers. Or
okay,
like that.
Fine.
Yeah.
That's fine. I'm happy. I was wondering if you had any knowledge of her being in touch with. Commercial enterprise or trying to push it commercially, push the concept commercially, and whether she had dialogue with, say, Decca, RCA, people like that.
No, not to my knowledge. The only contact which I'm aware of, somewhat involved in, was that she did ask the Minister for Arts at the time to come down to try and get a arts grant.
That was Jennifer
approval.
Lee, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
They were school friends or something as well. Or there was some sort
or
of
connection, yeah.
connection in there. But Jenny Lee just didn't want to know.
Right.
Wasn't interested.
Mm.
And the other thing was the initial application for patents.
Yeah.
The early stage.
Yeah, that's the next thing I was going to ask you.
And
were you involved with that?
Yes, I was there at the first interview when the patent officer came down to look at it. And his reaction immediately was, he said, this is far too advanced for anything that we can patent at the moment. He said, it's so complex, I cannot see it's going to be worth your expense because nobody will take it up. He said, the only thing that comes to mind is the shipbuilding industry. And she looked at him and gasped, more like you exchanged glances there. He said, and I explained why. He said, because when they punch the holes in the ship's plates, they need deburring. He said, you can generate any bloody frequency you like in any waveform. He said, and you can resonate at the deburring frequency and it'll be done. And with that, he left.
He sounds like a silly person.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So that was it.
Okay. Get to the next one. We've kind of skipped because lots of the things have been covered in sort of out of order. But
well, I'm like that.
Yeah, that's great.
I think naturally.
So, I spoke to somebody else recently who remembers seeing the machine in action as a child, but he was a small child. I don't know if you ever came across a chap called Oliver Barnicote, and. He said that the transport of the film tracks was very noisy and the machine itself would like kind of judder into life and was kind of a very noisy thing, and so then the actual listening of the piece would happen in another room. I was just wondering if...
Not to my recollection at all.
No, it wasn't...
There was a whir.
Yeah.
But I can assure you that anything that John Oram built was perfection.
Really, yeah.
Mm. Yeah. He was a precision perfectionist engineer.
Right.
Was he still sort of in touch and getting on with Daphne at the point where you left?
Yes.
Up to that point?
Yeah, there were beginning to become tensions.
Because I guess she was probably pushing him quite hard in a way, as far as like asking for lots of help. And
not during my time.
Right.
Actually, he was asking us for help because he had some engineering projects where he needed some electronic backup. So I was backing him up.
Oh, wow.
At that particular time. So Daphne took me to their home on several occasions where I would then work with John on his projects rather than anything to do with Auramics. But because he was a partner in the Electronic Studio Supply Company Limited with Daphne. Mm. So there were financial arrangements and, should we say, not agreement between them.
I can imagine and that the was, and that project was beginning, that drank was beginning money, to build. Didn't it? Kind of,
Yeah. Mm. Daphne never involved me in anything like that.
Mm.
So give her a dues. She kept me by design, or I think by design, plus the fact she was a private person, but I didn't get involved in any personal, financial or business details whatsoever. Mm. I didn't even really get involved in her studio work, commercial studio work, except for specific things like the Mallard exhibition and one or two other school projects.
Did you
and visiting Brenhall for updating tape recorders and things.
Did you come across Geoffrey Jones at all?
No.
The filmmaker?
No.
She did some really great soundtracks for his films. And he's quite a sort of... he's someone that should probably have more recognition than he currently does, I think. Yeah. I was just wondering. Because I can't find out barely anything about him, but his films are amazing. He's incredibly good at editing to sound. And obviously worked very closely on how those two things work together. So they're quite...
One of them, at least, is on the internet. You can see the snow one.
The British Rail.
Yeah.
No, you see, my only in connection there
put
is
it on the list to
with people like Muir Matheson, who was at Shepperton Studios with the Philharmonic Orchestra doing the soundtracks for the classic films and all the editing there.
Mm. Just going back to patents, commercial interests and so on, because a certain portion of my research is going to be to do with that. I was wondering if you had any comment on why Daphne never actually released a commercial product, or because she had, whether it be from a commercial side or from a altruistic educational side, she certainly had intentions for Auramics to, you know, spread out and infiltrate the world. Why do you think that kind of didn't happen in any major way?
Because she didn't understand it.
Ah.
Plus, it would have been expensive.
Yeah, so she would have needed.
She would have needed a lot more backing, commercial backing, or sort of entrepreneurial backing.
Mm.
But from the way I've seen things, how they developed, and how she has been, she was manipulated by me and by her brother.
Mm.
But within her concept, when we bowed out of her existence for whatever our reasons were. She then became influenced by other people who didn't have Auramics at heart.
Mm. Okay. And so what were the wrong turns, do you think? What were these sort of... Where were these bad influences taking her?
Well, I wasn't there at the time, but I'm only seeing the results in that her central focus seemed to be shifted.
Right.
Both socially, personally, and I think creatively. Mm. I can't put a finger on it because, as I say, I was so remote at the time.
I think a lot of people are struggling to put a finger on it because there certainly does seem to be a period of decline, kind of from about 1972, 1973, and then she comes back for a bit. Kind of, she gets her joie de vivre back a little bit later.
She started, to my knowledge, and my knowledge is third party from within the family.
Mm.
but she started to try and retrace some of her esoteric beliefs. And I have had sight of, now I don't know whether they're in the archives or not, but I've had sight of family information which shows that she was beginning to be influenced, shall we say, out of the real life scenarios. I've also had confirmed a belief which I held even while I was with Daphne, that she was under the influence of one or two so-called close friends and acquaintances who had their own personal agendas with Daphne as a person and with her as a composer, and I think they influenced her direction, which was almost it's on the tape, but you can erase it if you like, which I think was almost a form of emotional blackmail. And then she got involved in the sort of the programming side of this blooming BBC Micro, which was, if I'd been there, I'd have told her it was a non-starter, because I also had a BBC with my kids growing up from school. We used it for their homework and such like. I looked at their sound system and I realised it had potential, but it was useless as it stood. Three soundtracks and one noise track. Parameters you put in by a whole string of numerical data.
Machine code, essentially. Yeah.
Well, yes, you could put it in at BASIC. Daphne wanted to put it in machine code because it had faster access, but it didn't simulate anything like Neural Remix. So while she was mentally exhausting herself on that, she should have been doing something else. But I think it was a kind... I think she got into a state of depression, same as I did. And when you get into a certain emotional state, you take up projects which mask you from doing what you should be doing. It's rather like putting your head under a pillow. You don't want to face the reality, so you do something entirely different.
I wonder, because I find it really interesting how her, like the first kind of, when she moved to Tower Folly, for the first about 6 or 7 years,
she did some brilliant work, didn't she?
Yeah, she's doing some incredible compositional work, really amazing tape pieces. There's kind of, you can see in her writing and her notes and everything that she's very inspired to make a lot of different types of music, and there are no boundaries to what she's doing, really. And then it almost seems, like from an exterior perspective, from my perspective anyway, in the kind of 70s, she sort of loses her way for 5 or 6 years in a sort of parascience, strange kind of, do you know Sir George Trevelyan and that kind of...
Well, I think this was her abreaction to our split up, if you like. Same as mine was, that I lost my way for many years, tried to pick myself up, and then collapsed totally with the effort of trying to pick yourself up. And maybe it's that you, because you see more of her side than I know, you may see a parallel there.
You know, you're very welcome to come to the archive, and we'll show you around and show you things we've found.
But as I've said to the museum in the beginning, I don't travel well now.
Thank you
for the invite.
If we can be any help with anything like that, just do ask.
I wonder whether there might be stuff in the archive that you might kind of be intrigued about.
Very probably. My interest in all Remix now is purely to support you guys and people like Katie. I don't have any real personal interest in all Remix now.
But you're keen to see the truth be told, and
I'm keen to see the truth be told, both for Daphne and for myself. If I'm going to be recognised, let's be recognised for what I was or I wasn't.
That would
be nice, and that would be my legacy, and I'm quite content with that.
That leads me very neatly onto pretty much my last question, which was how do you think Daphne would have liked her legacy to be seen? What do you think she would like to be known as and for?
She would like to, I think, to have been totally respected for being an absolute free spirit, kicking against authority, breaking the known bounds and just being an experimentalist.